Melanie Mitchell is our guest on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell is here with me. I'm Paula. You talk about the growth of evolutionary thinking, biological thinking using machines, splitting off in, if I remember this correctly, neural networks, machine learning, and the third thing, which uses genetic algorithms.
Right, evolutionary computation.
Thank you. That's a hard one for me. These are all trying to get their hands around these same big issues, aren't they?
Right. So a lot of people sort of, I was just talking about expert systems, and one of the things that some people in artificial intelligence have concluded is that maybe that this expert system approach isn't the right way to go to get at more general kind of intelligence.
Is this the top-down thinking?
Right. This is where, say, I, as the software engineer, go in and write a bunch of rules that tells the program what to do depending on what it sees. And it turns out that it's really hard to write all the rules to do things. For instance, one of the things you'd like computers to do is, say, be able to recognize handwriting. Mm-hmm. You would think maybe there'd be a finite number of rules you could just write down to say, oh, this is the letter A, this is the letter B, and so on. It turns out you can't do that. So people have looked at a more biological kind of model or inspiration to say, well, humans or other animals can do what we want computers to do. How do they do it? So people have tried to mimic some aspects of the brain. That's neural networks. Those are computer programs that act in some ways like the brain and learn the way the brain does, very roughly. Then genetic algorithms use ideas from evolution to try and evolve programs that can think and or recognize patterns. So instead of I as a software engineer trying to program in the rules, instead I let them evolve and compete with other programs, like they might in, if they were animals out in the jungle,
in
the environment, yeah. Trying to, and the ones that succeed get to have children, reproduce. The children have slight differences from the parents, just like we have with our parents and our children, and then the children get to compete, and if they do well, they get to reproduce, and so on. And over many, many of these generations, and this is all happening inside the computer, many of these generations, you can sometimes get computer programs that actually do very well, better than what you might have been able to design them to do if you had sat down and had to program it yourself.
Oh, I can assure you it's done better than if I had to sit down and design it.
What you're describing is, you know, sounds like it's trending towards what has been discussed under the broad heading of complexity and complexity sciences, which I think is still a fairly amorphous notion.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who swear that it's irrelevant. There are other people that swear that this is the new science and this is the way we need to be doing science, or at least this is a major step forward. Can you clearly distinguish if there is, if you can do it legitimately, but between the, and I think of the difference between artificial life and the original version of artificial intelligence as an example, these rule-based systems that are, you know, that are based on what appear to be based on symbolic logic, for want of a better description, and systems that work from emergence, from these biological processes you talk about. Can you articulate that in a way that will make sense to us?
I can try, and probably if you asked somebody, one of my colleagues, you get a completely different answer. But in my view, what the science of complexity is, if you want to call it that, is trying to understand if you have something like, say, the human brain, where you have lots of individual cells or neurons that are connected to other neurons. Each neuron's connected to a relatively small number of other neurons. There's nobody controlling the show in your head. There's no king neuron. There's no central executive. Everybody's just doing their thing kind of independently, communicating. And somehow, out of all of that emerges, if you want to call it that, what we would call thinking. How does that work? How do you have a system in which you have lots of very relatively simple elements, like neurons, that are connected in relatively sparse ways, the way neurons are? They're, you know, not every neuron's connected to every other neuron, but it's much sparser than that. How does that kind of system behave in complicated ways, and how does it produce what we might call thinking or adaptive behavior? That kind of system isn't just limited to the brain. People think about complex systems, other complex systems being, for instance, the immune system, where you have lots and lots of cells in the body that are going around with antibodies, trying to look for invaders, for germs and diseases and so on, and destroying them in a very coherent kind of collectively organized way, and yet there's no central organizer. It's like a symphony without a conductor. How does that kind of system work?
Who's in charge here?
So I think of...
And the answer to how did that kind of system work is...
Well, that's what we're all trying to figure out.
Yeah.
This is what I would call the main problem of complex systems, is if you have this, what we would call a decentralized, distributed system, that's a system with lots of elements that are arrayed in some kind of spatial way, like the cells in the brain or the cells in the immune system, and they're communicating with each other. So a decentralized, distributed system, how does such a system produce organized behavior? And we see it all the time in nature. And we want to see it in the technology we build. So we want to build a computer that can do that. We want to build... We want to organize, for instance, our economy so that we get the kind of organized behavior we want.
You say that as if it's a given, but why would I want to do that? Is it more efficient? Is it more natural?
Or is this all about control?
I'd say it's more about lack of control.
Who's in charge?
Why do we want to do that? Well, one reason is that the systems in nature that we see that do the things that we want, that are able to think, that are able to learn, that are able to organize in ways so that they adapt to their environments, they have this property. They look like this kind of system. Another example is that you can think of a colony of ants as another kind of system like this, where there's no ant in charge. You know, the queen ant's down in the nest having babies all the time. She's not running things. The ants are kind of doing their own thing, and yet they're very efficient at, as a whole, at creating a very adaptive system where they can survive and prosper for long periods of time. So as a computer scientist, you know, I'm saying I want to be able to do this kind of thing in computers. I want to be able to develop computer systems that are adaptive in that kind of way.
You've now said that three times, and I remember in the book you'd saying that John Holland, is really looking at systems that can adapt. Isn't this notion of adaptability in nature and within the machines that we are creating, isn't this ability to adapt right at the heart of a lot of what you're talking about?
I think it is. This chess program that beat Kasparov, it can't adapt. It adapts maybe in very, very limited ways. It can't do some other thing besides chess. If suddenly I, you know, hold a hammer over the computer and say, I'm going to blow out your circuit boards if you don't play checkers.
Well, it probably could not do checkers
without
doing some serious reprogramming.
That's right. Or even, you know, a modified kind of chess that humans could adapt pretty well to.
So part of the benefit, and trying to follow along, is that, you know, if the world were static, that adaptability would be probably less important. But if things move around us, then the ability to adapt to a changed environment presumably has some advantages.
It has every advantage. In fact,
It's
called evolution. The things that couldn't adapt died out. And people in evolution study what they call the evolution of adaptability. So even the ability to adapt maybe has increased over time. You know, we don't know for sure, but people think about that, that being able to change, to do something different when circumstances call for it, is really the hallmark of life.
And that's out of the adaptability as being revolving state. Adapting to the ability to adapt is in some ways very, very central to what you're talking about.
Yes. And, you know, I'm thinking of adaptation in a very broad sense. It doesn't just mean, for instance, evolving in the Darwinian sense, but also learning during our lifetimes, you know, being able to change the way that we act from day to day or from year to year or, you know, culturally over a longer period of time, having societies be able to adapt. And one of the things that people in the complex systems world have claimed, and, you know, I don't know if I believe this or not, that all these systems that adapt have something in common, that there can be a science of adaptation, or what they call complex adaptive systems, and that we can come up with general principles that underlie all of these systems.
This is Melanie Mitchell. She is our guest on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are with her in Los Alamos, New Mexico. We're all going to be back in just a minute. We hope you're with us when we return.